Outside, we couldn't see it from our vantage point.
Wrestling fans, and welcome to Our Vantage Point, the Retro Wrestling Podcast. This is episode number 13. I am Joe Murata alongside Michael Quinn. How you doing, Quinn?
Unlucky 13.
Unlucky 13.
It's good. Is it lucky?
It's lucky number 13.
Wait, which one's the lucky one?
The lucky one is the fans, because they get to be with us for the next hour as we talk about the world of retro wrestling, some things we remember, and some things we wish we didn't. Good to be with you guys this Monday, January 9th, 2017. Hope your year is going well so far.
I'd say it's been a good year so
far.
It's
been a great year.
Only 9 days.
Only 9 days old. Quinn, I understand, before we get started here, I understand that people can subscribe if they haven't yet. You want to tell everyone where that might be?
Oh, there's all sorts of tactics involved with this. Okay. You can always go to iTunes.
Right, iTunes.
iTunes.web, whatever it is. Go over there and you can subscribe. We're on that. You can go to Google Play Now Music.
Google Play Music.
And you can go get it over there, too. It's the same kind of subscription kind of thing.
Right.
You can go over to the Stitcher.
Oh, yeah, the Stitcher. Yeah. Right, right.
FM.radio. What's it called?
Player.fm.
Player.fm.
We are on that. It is wonderful. It is one of my favorite things,
And you can always go to the website, too.
Oh, yeah, the website.
We have all the subscription links over there. You can even subscribe on SoundCloud if you want to listen to it that way.
Aren't we also on something like with the Blueberry?
All right.
Who cares?
But we are on the Blueberry.
We are on the Blueberry. BLUBRRY.com. Of course, Quinn, we are at the Place to Be Nation.
Oh, we are.
What do you think of the place? It's a nice place.
It's a nice, you know, setup here. It's got a good couch.
Nice decor.
Nice decor.
And you know what else they have?
I hear it in the background. They have other podcasts.
They do. They have other podcasts. You guys should check those out. I don't want to fail to mention, you can tweet at us at OVP Podcast on the Twitter. You can also email us at ovppodcast@gmail.com. That is ovppodcast@gmail.com.
We do email.
We do the email. We're up on that email.
Yep. We're on top of that tech.
We're on top of that tech. We're going to start today with our first segment, of course, which is One Thing That I Miss. And it's something that I miss. I'll be starting this one. Quinn, this is going to surprise you.
Okay.
If you've been listening to these past episodes, folks, you might notice that I have a slant towards a certain wrestling promotion. However, I miss WCW.
Huh.
The WCW!
Well, I miss WCW a lot.
I really do.
I really miss it.
I was thinking this the other day, and I believe me, we could go on for decades about some stupid decisions they made.
I think this segment shouldn't be about
it's,
like
that's
what they
I was
going
to say. It's
like,
not going to be.
This is what I remember or what I miss. So
some things we remember, and some things we wish we didn't. The thing is you know, we both got into wrestling right around the same time, Quinn and I, 94, 95.
Right.
And I got into WWF first, and I knew who they were even before I watched them, but I saw that Hogan ticker tape parade thing that I hate so much. That was, I think, my first exposure to WCW in June
of
94.
That's unfortunate, because that's some of the dumbest WCW stuff ever.
It is, but I'll tell you this, as a 9-year-old, as a 10-year-old, 11-year-old, and all the way up until they went out of business, it was nice to have an alternative.
Yes, and I think I commented on this in a previous episode about, if you wanted more wrestling, you could always go watch WCW.
And it was good wrestling. It wasn't cheap crap. You know?
Yeah, it wasn't like an indie fed.
No.
Like, it was like, no, this is like has Turner money behind it, and like the ring is good and the lighting's good. And, you know, it's got some superstars, some of their own, and some guys that were from WWF. And,
yeah. I mean, when I started watching, it was literally WWF Junior, because you had Hogan, you had Savage, Dougie and Honky Tonk
now,
Man, Brutus Beefcake was there, you know.
To be fair,
go ahead.
I feel like the majority of the roster was not just, like, WWF people. Like, they had a whole, like, very comprehensive undercard.
Well, they had, like, Big Van Vader was there, Diamond Dallas Page.
Right.
Johnny B. Badd.
And about that time they were I know it's a little early, but I know about that time they were starting to phase in cruiserweights. Like, it was a little later, but
late 95 into 96, yeah.
So there was that
Malenko,
in there.
Mysterio.
Jericho.
Jericho came in later, yeah. Eddie Guerrero.
Yeah.
They had such a good alternative to the WWF's product, even though they carried a lot of the same faces.
Yep.
That helped the experience because you'd be familiar with these faces.
You'd be familiar, but you also, they had new adversaries.
Exactly. Like, they had new adversaries. Obviously, the NWO blew that up in a totally different direction in a good way, where you had, hey, is that Hulk Hogan? What's he doing here? You know, like that kind of thing.
Well, you know what? It's funny. You were introduced to WCW with the Hulk Hogan thing, right?
I saw it on TV somehow.
I remember when it was announced, and my mom's boyfriend, he kind of got me into wrestling, he had mentioned, that was the first time I heard about WCW. It was like, oh, did you hear Hulk Hogan went to WCW? It's like a big deal.
And you were like, what?
Yeah. Anyway, but my first, like, my biggest memories of, like, first watching WCW was the whole Diamond Dallas Page versus Mark Marrow, Johnny B. Bad, whatever.
That was fun.
Angle. Yeah. It's like, I always cite it as so good, and it's just one of those angles, it's silly, but it just felt like these two hated each other, and if you recall, we can go into it, we're talking about WCW, right?
Go ahead.
Basically, DDP had a feud with Johnny B. Bad. They kind of, you know, traded wins and losses for a while, and at some point along the line, DDP got his hands on the TV title,
mm-hmm.
and then their feud continued, and then they built this whole thing where, like, Kimberly was, like, or the Diamond Doll.
Yeah, because he mistreated her. He wasn't very good to her.
Well, it was funny, though. And then he had, like, Max Muscle with him, like, as a goon.
He did have Max Muscle for a while.
Yeah,
sure.
So DDP had, like, this whole entourage, and he was old-school, like, dicky heel, and Johnny B. Bad was the likable face. And finally, he faces him in a match where the escort services of the Diamond Doll are on the line.
Yeah.
And Johnny B. Bad wins, and then she becomes the...
She was called.
I think she was just Kimberly at first.
Yeah, because then Johnny B. Bad left, and they replaced him with the Booty Man feud.
But before that happened, they had one more match.
Yes.
And this is where the whole angle became awesome.
This is one of your favorite things.
It is one of my favorite things. It should be the one of my favorite things segment. But basically, they reveal that, like, DDP was rich because, like, Kimberly won, like, the lottery
or bingo money,
and he was just spending her money left and right.
Yep.
And so they had a match where DDP would, like, now that they were broken up, it was like he would give all the money back if he lost or something.
And he lost.
And the best part about this is on Saturday night, like, he would be in, like, the gutter. They would, like, film vignettes where he was, like, a homeless man. And then, like...
He would be giving his attire away and
right,
his rings.
And, like, the debuting, like, Disco Inferno was, like, coming out with his, like, DDP rings on and, like, jobbers.
Jobbers had his tights and stuff.
Jobbers in random matches that had nothing to do with DDP would have his tights on.
It was a nice little touch. That was... That, see, folks, if you weren't watching at the time, it wasn't like it is now with TNA. As your only mainstream, and I'm using that term very lightly, mainstream,
right.
You know, rival or, you know, not even really rival, but competition to WWE. At the time, there was a period of time where WCW was winning the ratings war.
Yeah, they would actually, like, trade one-upsmanship with WWE. They actually competed. That's something you can't really say about anything
they
nowadays.
They ran a show against WWF's flagship, Monday Night Raw, and it beat the shit out of it for almost 2 years.
Yeah, and even before it started beating the shit out of it, it was like a 50-50, like, proposition.
In
really.
95 and 96, it was. It was a back-and-forth type of thing.
It wasn't like WWF likes to act like they had, like, some superior product beforehand.
They didn't.
And that they always had a superior product, but they really didn't. WCW was just as good, if not better, at certain points.
At certain points, yeah. I mean, WCW's 94, I'm going to go on the record and say this, WCW's 94, before Hogan got involved, and even at Bash in the Beach when he did, was
pretty
killer.
Good.
Yeah, it was awesome.
Yeah,
Flair,
it's really good.
Vader, Boss Man,
right?
Sting, Rude,
yep.
He had a great roster, Steve Austin, Brian Pillman,
it's true.
Cactus Jack. Yeah.
And even though they had some bad years even before that, and a lot of people like to cite 93,
is pretty crappy.
It's pretty crappy.
But look on the other side. I mean, that's not well-regarded either.
No, exactly. But even before that, even like 91, 92, I mean, it's not that bad.
91's like, a little rough.
91's bad because they lose Flair and they're like, what do we do? Because,
yeah.
But that would happen. Yeah, but that would happen to anybody if they lost their, like, number one guys. You know what I mean?
I guess. I mean, WWF did okay without Hogan in 92 and 93.
Yeah, but they were preparing for him to leave.
Okay, fair.
WCW, just the rug just got snatched under them and they didn't have Flair and Luger anymore.
Fair enough. Like, now, folks, I also want to clarify one other thing. When I say WCW, I mean WCW, meaning post-Crockett.
Yeah,
what I'm referring to.
Yeah, and to be fair to the Crockett era, that is like,
it's great.
That's probably way better than anything WCW ever did.
Yeah, I'm not even talking NWA. Yeah. I mean, NWA is great, but that's a whole different animal.
I think WCW gets crapped on as a whole really because of the end, rather than its highlight
years. It got rough after like 99 to 01.
Right.
It was tough to watch, and I did watch it up until... I didn't watch it in 01, did you? I watched it maybe until
I didn't really watch it in 01 or even 2000.
Yeah.
Like, I kind of was like... Once they... You know what was always like a marker to me? And I...
Let's see if it's the same as
it's
mine.
It's not... I'm not going to say the logo, because we always say
no,
the logo.
No, that's a joke.
But like... One thing, and I don't think I've mentioned this before, but when they started adding, like, the hardcore division, I'm like, now this is just, like, copying.
Yes.
Like, it's like, there's nothing different.
They moved the commentators to ringside after they were always away from the ring for so long.
Yeah, that was, like, the WCW trademark. It was, like, the commentators were away from the ring.
And then they put the refs in stripes.
Yeah, they
same way WWF did. It was all visual cues.
Once they took the uniqueness out of the product, everything got darker.
Yep.
You know, like,
everything
how Raw
got darker.
Was. Like... And I don't mean darker in, like, a tone. I mean literally the
lighting
darker.
Was darker. Yeah.
Like,
a lot of that was during the Vince Russo era. I'm not sure what he had to do with that, but it coincided with when he was booking for a while.
Yeah.
That's when it got really hard to watch.
Now, I do commend them for one thing during that, when they were trying to steer the ship.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was a bold move, and I don't think it gets a lot of credit, is doing an actual reboot.
They did. In April of 2000, folks, they brought Eric Bischoff back. They brought Vince Russo back.
Right.
They both were now on screen, but in real life, working together.
Right.
And what did they do, Quinn? They just kind of, like, stripped all the titles,
basically,
right?
Like, Russo and Bischoff together in the ring, united, like, trying to say, like, look, no, this is, like, an organized thing. This isn't kayfabe. Like, we're just coming out here and we're saying, look, everything starts from scratch.
Yep.
Everyone give up your belts. We're rebooting the product. Sometimes I wish the WWE now would do that.
Yeah.
Because it's just so garbage. Like, right?
We were talking that.
If anybody would have the courage to fucking reboot their product. WCW, I can say that much about them.
They had the balls
to just say, this isn't working, and we're just going to reboot everything.
But like, didn't it turn into, if I'm not mistaken, and this is probably why it didn't work, didn't it essentially turn into the NWO rehash, but instead of it being the NWO, it was the New Blood versus the Millionaires Club?
They tried to, which on paper isn't a bad idea.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that the veterans are the problem with this company and that the New Blood are like the new up-and-comers and they're going to do it. But the problem is that the veterans were the faces.
Yeah, I don't know how that happened. I don't know if that
was
intended.
It was like immediately.
That was bad.
Because I think what they did was by grouping the veterans together. The problem is that you had guys that were pretty much always baby faces, like Sting in there,
mm-hmm.
right? And it's like, well, how do you shape Sting as a heel just because he's a veteran? That's not fair.
That's true.
Like,
that's a good point.
Like, doesn't make any sense, right?
And that's a good point.
Yeah.
They had a lot of misfires. They also had a lot of fun. I mean, Quinn and I both love the TV title series, the Best of Seven series from 1998.
The Best 1998. Of Seven is good. It involves a bad man.
Booker T and Chris Benoit. And 98 also was great. It had the rise of Chris Jericho.
Well, I mean, I know we've talked in general, the TV title in general.
Yep.
I mean, I would think the two things that always stand out to me in WCW is the Cruiserweight division and the television title division. They were like the crown jewels, the unique aspects of WCW, and all the ring work, even the stories were good in there. Like that Johnny B. Bad DDP
thing,
that was a
little
TV
story.
Title thing.
It was a great little story. I would say that one of the things about WCW that I always noticed as a kid and I notice now, and it's a credit to the way they presented themselves, it's a credit to their announcers, to Tony Schiavone particularly, is it sounded important when they were wrestling.
This was a sport, and they were going to fight for belts, and that they were like... They always gave this aspect like that there was some kind of like the whole world of wrestling was like there was other federations, but WCW was like, this is where, I know they said the big boys, I know it's a cliche, but this is like
look at the adjective.
Yeah.
This is where the big boys play, huh? Look at the adjective. Play.
But to not say that, let's just say this is where, like, the top competitors in the world come to compete.
Right.
Like,
this is where the best of the best are.
Yeah.
And if you win our title, you are at the top of your profession.
It's kind of ironic. WCW always was known for importance on their belts, right?
Yes. And
but they committed the most egregious title error that they could have done. And it makes sense that the company sunk once, because that was really, they could always, their bread and butter was they had the prestige of their world title that could trace it back to George Hackenschmidt and whatever.
Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah, Abraham,
to
whatever.
Say,
that they had that belt,
true.
Right?
Yeah.
And then by giving it to Arquette, that's when they, like, that's when it was like, that was the last thing they could always hang their hat on and say, we have the world title, like.
You're not a wrestler!
Now, baby, is that any way to talk to the heavyweight champion of the world?
Oh, good God.
I don't know, Quinn. I don't know if that's what did them in. That's like puking on a pile of shit.
No,
it was like they were already in the toilet by the time they gave it to Arquette.
It's a mentality thing. It's that.
Who did he beat for it? I can't
even
remember
Jarrett.
That.
Well, it was like Jeff Jarrett and DDP in like a triple cage thing or something.
So Jeff Jarrett had the world title?
Yeah.
That ain't no better.
And it was. At least he's a wrestler.
Yeah.
Like,
Vince Russo won the title, too.
Last week on Nitro, I proved to the entire world that at any given time, I could become the WCW champion.
Vince Russo won the title, but Vince McMahon won the WWF title, so whatever.
I didn't say that was good.
Yeah. But my point is that once WCW could, like, they didn't really have anything at that point, right?
Mm.
By that point.
By now, 2000, yeah.
Now the last vestige that they lose is having the prestige of their belts. I mean, they got rid of the TV title, which was so important.
True.
They kind of demoted the cruiserweights like they were garbage.
They
Kiwi
unmasked
and all that crap.
Kiwi. Jindrak.
Yeah, Jindrak. No, well,
Jindrak.
I will
what's
say
his name?
Jindrak and
Who
all
cares?
Them. That was part of the whole like young tag teams movement. That was fine.
They were the sucky like.
Yeah, they weren't
Sean
good.
O'Hare.
Sean O'Hare and Jindrak. Whatever. But that was fine because it was like okay, young
yeah.
is fine. That's fine.
Yeah.
But when you get rid of your TV title and you make your world title look like bullshit. Why should I ever care about anything in this company anymore?
The finger poke didn't do them any favors
it
either with the world title.
At least it's about who's holding it. And even if it's a finger poke, it went to Hulk Hogan. It's fucking Hulk Hogan. I mean,
it's Hulk Hogan.
They can shield a little bit of that.
Sure. So you're saying Arquette? You're not saying Arquette was the nail in the coffin, but you're saying it was like a bit of a fatal blow.
Right, because you're basically your bedrock is your titles.
Is the guy from Scream?
No,
wins
no.
the title.
I'm not saying he's the bedrock. I'm saying your titles themselves were a big bedrock of this company.
Right.
And to just like they're done. Like, what else do you have left to hold on? It's just an indie fed at that point.
With a very expensive television deal, and that's one of the things that wasn't picked up. And that's what happened, folks. It just unceremoniously was bought by Vince McMahon. No TV stations would pick it up. And it's been over 15 years now, going on 16. Sometimes I wish that there was suitable competition.
Right. And I didn't want to end it on a bad note. But I wanted to just remember the good things about WCW.
Yeah.
I mean, there were so many good moments, too. I don't want to just stop there.
I understand.
I want to say, like, listen... Like Luger winning the world title from Hulk Hogan.
Even though it was only for a few days, that
was
so huge.
Happy.
Yeah.
And the time that Dean Malenko was Cyclope.
And unmasked
against
Jericho, sure.
And Jericho didn't see it coming, and he was like this horrible cruiserweight champion
sure.
that was making a mockery.
Yeah.
And again, bedrock, the titles were respected, and you had a guy disrespecting it, and he was big heel because of it.
Yeah, that's very true.
Like,
there was a lot of great moments about WCW. What made them great is when they were different than WWF.
Exactly.
When they had to or tried to become a light, watered-down version of WWF, it didn't work.
No.
Because that wasn't the heart of WCW.
Their core audience was coming because it was unique and different.
Yep. And
it wasn't
the
WWE.
Because of the tradition, because of the history, because of loyalty.
You know, say what you will about Ric Flair in the later years, but I said this in an episode. What he represented was that tradition in that time.
Yes.
And you kind of needed him there. Like, even if he was just going to lose or whatever, because he wasn't winning anymore.
Not really.
But it was the idea that Ric Flair's there and that he's a carryover from the days when they were you know, the best.
Right. Savage, take or leave him. Hogan, take him or leave him. Right. All those WWF guys. But Flair, that was WCW.
Yeah.
Flair and Sting.
Flair and Sting. That was them.
We're WCW. Yeah. So that'll wrap it up on this segment, folks. I also wanted to mention one little minor thing. Bret Hart always seemed to call it the WCW.
WCW!
Which I thought was very funny. But anyway, speaking of funny, we're going to take a break. We'll be back right after this.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
We're back with WCW. Goldberg's in trouble. Ming to the front. Back he goes to the turnbuckle. Into the gut. But Goldberg rebounds with a headbutt. Ming on the outside. Ming gets a chair. Goldberg gets a chair. This could get ugly. They're gonna eat pizza.
Little Caesar's WCW meal. Get a free WCW motion card when you order two medium pizzas for just $9.99. Collect all four.
Pizza, pizza.
I'll trade you these three for a Goldberg.
Nope. You're listening to Our Vantage Point, the Retro Wrestling Podcast, the fastest growing weekly episodic retro wrestling audio podcast in the world.
Welcome back to Our Vantage Point, your retro wrestling podcast, this Monday, January 9th, 2017. Quinn, I understand there's something going on about us being this growing audio.
You mean we're the fastest growing weekly episodic retro wrestling audio podcast in the world?
Yeah.
I think that's right.
That's us, yeah. And you can help us grow. You can follow us on Twitter, and you can tweet at us. You can tweet us pictures. You can tweet us thoughts, questions, comments, complaints.
There's other things you can do, too.
What else can you do?
They can give us a rating on iTunes.
You know what? That would be nice, actually. That would help us out. Maybe we can get that Colt Cabana, you know?
Yeah, we can
catch
surpass
up to him.
Colt Cabana and all the other... The list, I don't know what it's called. There's like an NXT,
The Rush. I don't know what it's called.
It's the only wrestling podcast I ever see on the new Noteworthy, and one day I want to catch it.
Can't be that noteworthy if you don't remember the name of it.
Yeah, the Rush. It's some NXT podcast.
The Rush.
Something about Hawk. I don't know. Who knows? Oh, I never listened to it.
That's fine. So our next segment, folks, is called What Do You Think Of? Quinn is going to ask me what I think of something. I don't know what it is. Let's find out.
Okay, so this one, I always like to make it fun for the What Do You Think Of?
Yes, you do.
So what do you think of, drum roll, managers.
Managers, it's a lost art.
Yeah.
I miss managers.
I love managers.
I miss the idea of there being someone that handles a wrestler's contracts.
Right.
Matches.
And maybe we should discuss kind of the background of why there is managers first.
Well, back in the day, way back in the day, there used to be managers, 70s,
yeah.
60s.
Mostly prominent. They started really in the 70s, yeah, I'd say, like 70s. Having like big-time managers.
And what they would do, basically, is their whole idea is that they would be the mouthpiece for their wrestler.
Right, and that's the behind the scenes, but there's also the kayfabe.
The kayfabe is that they were handling all of their contracts. They were signing the matches.
They were handling the purse money.
They were handling the money, right.
Yeah, like that there was like, just by them existing gives you this background kayfabe world that there's like some kind of business involved in just the wrestlers wrestling.
Right, exactly. Like that there was more than meets the eye. It wasn't just a guy in a bathing suit punching another guy in a bathing suit.
Right. If you look at wrestling before that era, I mean, really, managers kind of coincide with wrestling starting to ramp up and get bigger, I would say, in the 70s, really.
I guess so. I don't know of any notable managers from before the 60s. I mean, I know Bobby Heenan was already managing in the 60s.
Yeah, but, I mean, he was also probably wrestling in the 60s.
He was also wrestling in the 60s. Blassie was an early manager,
right.
70s.
But that kind of brings us to, I guess, the first managers.
The wave.
The first wave, big three, right?
Well, the WWF, Captain Lou Albano.
Hey, paisanos, it's the Super Mario Brothers Super Show!
Who was immensely successful.
Excellent manager, too.
Yeah, as a mouthpiece, I mean, he was unparalleled at the time. He made people hate him and his wrestler.
What I like about Albano is that he could, it almost was like anything this guy did, they would hate.
Yes.
And it to the point where, like, remember we were watching that, like, that 70s championship wrestling or something? And, like, not the one we reviewed, like, another one? And, like, Vince is just, like, the disdain in his voice. Yeah. He called him, like, a big fat slob.
Yes, he did. He called him a big fat slob. It was like he was universally hated.
People just couldn't stand the guy.
He drew heat. He drew money.
He would do things like, if he was managing, like, a Japanese wrestler, he'd say fake Japanese.
Yes.
Like as if, and because it was, like, the 70s and there wasn't, like, the internet, and people couldn't, like, look up what Japanese sounded like. They just thought he was, they thought he was probably, like, some evil foreigner, or he was like mingling with evil foreigners.
Right,
he knew their language and stuff, and that he was just like this crazy guy, basically.
Right, and then you had a guy like Freddie Blassie, classy Freddie Blassie, who the Hollywood fashion plate. Right,
right. That was thought his he nickname. Was better than everyone.
Thought he was better. Called
he was
everyone
rich.
He was rich. He called everyone a pencil neck geek.
Right,
and those pencil neck geeks out there don't know what's going on.
He also infamously or famously, depending on how you want to look at it, managed the Iron Sheik.
Right.
And he was what, Quinn?
He was the Ayatollah Blassie.
With
and there you go, again, with the more heat.
Yep.
A lot of the managers, I always feel that in those early days, those big three, it was a lot about capitalizing on foreigners, and that if a manager who was American was managing a foreigner, he would almost, like, adopt.
Yes.
The the culture.
Sure, that happens.
Just to piss off the crowd.
Absolutely.
Because you have to remember, when Blassie was doing this, it's like, there was the whole Iran...
Cold War, too.
The Iran oil crisis
was only
a couple of years before.
Sure, the hostage situation.
And the Iran-Contra scandal, mm-hmm. and all this stuff. Like, there was, like, it kind of coincided with the news and stuff, right?
Right. The manager's job, up until it became a lost art, which I guess we'll get into as we go on.
Yeah.
Was to draw heat,
right?
Draw money, and make people want to see the matches of the guy that he was managing.
Right, and also talk for him.
Yeah.
Now, sometimes it seemed like it was neither here or there with the talking part early on. From what I'm seeing when I'm watching older stuff now, there's some guys who can talk and have managers, but they're just big heels.
Right. Absolutely. And we should also clarify, the really successful managers, the really notable ones, they were usually heel managers. Face managers were, and still are, very nondescript.
Well, I never understood why a face would need a manager.
Well, how about Arnold Skoland? He managed Backlund and Sammartino before that.
All that really was is to make Backlund look more squeaky clean, basically.
And legitimate,
like,
maybe.
It's like, oh, this guy's got, like, it's... Arnie was almost like a coach rather than a manager.
Remember he sat, we were making fun of him because when we reviewed that one a couple weeks ago, he sat in the chair at ringside.
I don't know if there's any vignettes from the 70s or anything, but I would just envision there would be something where Arnold Skoland's like training Bob Backlund in a gym or something. Like, that's like what he is.
Yeah, you're probably right. You know, that's like, probably the mentality with it.
He's like Mick or something from Rocky.
He's like Mick from Rocky, but not as entertaining.
Let's get through this big three.
Yeah.
The Grand Wizard.
The Grand Wizard, who wore like a turban.
Which is automatically makes him a heel.
But he was a white guy.
He was just kind of like an Italian guy.
Skinny, probably Jewish.
Yeah, I don't know
Ernie
what he was.
Ernie Roth
was
his real name.
Okay,
so.
Yeah, he was Jewish then.
And he just was like a skinny guy in a suit.
Well, to begin with, I see nothing sensational about Rocky Johnson except his delusions of grandeur.
Yeah,
he was just sleazy.
He was basically before Slick. He was kind of the Slick,
I guess, if you want. Yeah, the C-level manager, sure.
Right, he was the low-tier manager, but he was kind of slimy, like almost Jimmy Hart. Kind of too.
Almost Jimmy Hart. Like, he, Grand Wizard died, and I want to say, I don't know, 82, 83. Fuji became a manager in the mid-80s, and Fuji was another notable manager.
Right.
He was the devious one, Quinn, and can you elaborate on that for the folks a little bit?
What I like about Fuji with that devious thing
as a manager,
he would always smile, mm-hmm. right?
Mr. Fuji, if I may, of course, a tremendous Chinatown population here in the Bay Area. Perhaps some words in your native tongue to whatever few fans you may have.
Voisan, I am not Chinese, so sorry. Ha ha, joke on you, Voisan.
And they'd always call him devious because you're almost like, what is this guy's motive?
Yeah,
like,
what's he up to?
You can't tell because and then sometimes he'll just hit somebody with a cane for no reason.
Yeah, or throw salt at him.
Yeah.
Right?
Without any provocation or anything. Like, usually managers would have to be, like, you know, poked or prodded a little bit before they might get involved.
Yeah,
but Fuji would just, for freaking no reason, in the middle of the match, just like, eh.
Yeah.
Like, throw the sand at him.
Yeah.
Ceremonial salt.
Or dirt.
Yeah, whatever it was. Baby powder.
I liked Fuji as a manager.
I do like Fuji. And then the cool thing about Fuji is that they kind of kept going with him. Like, they would, like, do the Fuji vice with Don Morocco.
Yeah, which is,
like,
great.
Yeah, there was, like, this weird, like, also Fuji kind of had a sense of humor kind of thing.
Yeah, he was an entertaining character.
Yeah, and he also could be serious, too.
Absolutely. And another guy, like, you didn't like him at the time. You know, no. Like, no one did. You're not like, oh, that Mr. Fuji is awesome.
Right.
It's a different era. You're like, no, kick that guy's ass. He's
exactly.
throwing salt at the people
and
I like.
Plus, he's got the evil foreigner. And
evil foreigner,
and
right.
And I would say Fuji's a good transition, if we're going to talk, out of the big three. That
yeah.
Basically, if you wanted to look at how managers were originally, the way the WWF worked was basically it was those three would manage basically all the heels.
Yeah, a lot of heels. If you were managed, you usually meant something.
There wasn't really heels who didn't have a manager.
It was there was
then.
A period of time where it's yeah. true. It was rare to not have one right. if you were a heel.
Right. So then they get into the Hogan era, right?
Yeah. So
all
by
these managers are kind of phasing out
right.
the big three.
By this time, Grand Wizard has died. Blassie retired in 86 and brought in the Slick, who we'll get to in one sec.
Mm-hmm.
And then
Albano became heel.
Or he became face.
Face. Sorry.
So Albano became face. So then we bring in a guy like Slick.
You bring in the Slickster, right? And the Slickster now, I love the Slickster because it's like no shame, this character.
Yeah.
Like, right? Like,
why in the world would a man who is a former Intercontinental Heavyweight Champion, a man who is respected and cheered and loved, adored by these
revered
media. Oh, don't you shut up and give me a chance, but I got to say, you onion here.
He clearly looks like he's either a pimp
or a drug
cocaine dealer.
Yeah.
Something nefarious that somehow he got money and all of a sudden.
But it's very shady.
It's not on the up and up, right?
Right.
Like, Gorilla used to say, I would not buy a used car from
yeah,
the Slickster.
Or I wouldn't trust him as far as I can throw him across
right.
the street, Jess.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, something like that.
And it was just, Slick was, he was Slick.
He was Slick.
He
was
literally was Slick.
The Doctor of Style.
He was the Doctor of Style. Where's he getting all this money? You could never figure it out.
It was never really explained. And he was a great manager, in my opinion. Maybe even an underrated manager because, well, first of all, the music. We all love
Jive Soul,
Jive Soul Bro.
Yeah, of course.
Awesome song. But he did stuff. He interfered. He got yep. involved, especially in his earlier days.
Now, the funny part is Slick was, is he was actually like a skinny dude.
Yes.
And so when the faces finally had enough of them, he was great at selling. Even when they would just grab him by the collar, he would jump all over the place like the babyface was the strongest person in the world.
Yep.
And if he got punched, he'd fly across the
yeah,
ring. Right?
He was great at taking the bumps and
yeah.
stuff like that. Now, I don't want to spend too much time on this one particular person because we could do a whole episode, but Bobby Heenan might be the best manager I've ever seen
Bobby
in my life.
Bobby Heenan is the greatest manager of all time, in my opinion.
I would agree.
And if we're going chronologically here, he's in this era. You can't
yes.
talk about managers without talking about Bobby the Brain Heenan.
Fantastic.
I don't want to go too much into
yeah.
him. As far as a manager is concerned,
excellent.
He did everything that a manager should do. He made everyone seem important.
Yep.
He had a stable.
He had a stable, a family, he called it.
He had a family. Now, Bobby, I think, was kind of unique because they would it seems like they would roughly mention that there was a stable, but Bobby was big on that all these guys are his friends of his and they'll work together.
Yep.
Like, if there was a Royal Rumble or something, like,
yeah.
the Heenan family would gang up on
him. They would
people.
Gang up on him. Yep.
Right. Like, it's that there was, like, collusion with Bobby's people.
Yeah. And he did everything that a manager should do. He got his guys over. He talked for them. He generated heat for them.
Right.
Hell, WrestleMania 3 being the prime example.
Right. Bobby was where he was at because he was that good.
He was that damn good.
If we're
good.
Just going to, let's just keep it at a managing aspect
sure.
for Bobby, right?
Yeah.
It makes sense that he, as the best manager they had, that he would take on the mantle of Andre the Giant, the biggest.
Yes.
The biggest heel turn.
Yeah, absolutely.
Would be perpetrated by Bobby the Brain Heenan.
Yep, exactly. And he managed him up until WrestleMania 6.
Until his career was over, basically.
Yep.
And Bobby, you know, Bobby just, it was always exciting, too. There was always this element of Bobby was so big, but he would fail a lot, right?
Yes.
Because he was always facing it was either all or nothing fighting Hogan, right?
It was almost always against Hogan. Yeah, you
right.
can't beat Hogan back
But when
then.
Bobby got an Intercontinental title or a tag team title, it
yeah.
seemed like the biggest deal in the world, and it was like, well, that's, I also felt like there was this aspect of, well, it's easy for Bobby to get an Intercontinental title or a tag title because he's just such a good manager.
And he had two great tag champions, Rick Rude, I mean, Intercontinental Intercontinental Champions, Rick Rude and Mr. Perfect.
Yeah. And I felt the one, I always felt, and I don't know if this is true or not, but that they gave Bobby Ric Flair as almost like an honorary, like, okay, you're not going to be managing anymore, but let's say that we can put in your resume, basically, you managed a world champion.
He technically did, and that was implicit and somewhat explicit. He was Flair's manager, but he was called his financial advisor, and Mr. Perfect was his, like,
executive
consultant. But Bobby Heenan was definitely a part of managing Ric Flair.
Right.
He just did it from the broadcast booth.
Right.
He still managed him. In name.
Exactly.
In name. He didn't accompany him to ringside. He did a couple of times early in Flair's run.
He was the one to bring the belt and propose a match with Hogan at SummerSlam 91.
You're bringing in one of the biggest names in the business. It's only natural that you give him the biggest manager in the business.
Right.
Now, there's another manager that came into the WWF around the same time, and that would be Jimmy Hart. He was a little B-tier.
Yeah, B-tier, a little under Bobby.
A little under Bobby.
I'd say he was higher than Slick.
He was. He had...
He was mostly tag teams, I always felt, Bobby.
Yeah.
Jimmy was mostly tag teams. And the Honky Tonk Man.
And he had the Honky Tonk Man.
That was his crown jewel.
He had the Hart Foundation.
Yeah.
He had some good guys. He had Earthquake, who I really like.
I always liked Jimmy because with him managing, it always felt like he had a guy with a title always.
He did. He had the Nasties.
Yeah.
And he got involved, too, and that megaphone, that ever-present megaphone would be used, you know? That you had to watch for that.
Yeah. I mean, Jimmy Hart was... He was just a good manager. He was good at being obnoxious.
You know, baby, I've managed a lot of great tag teams in the past, but I have never, ever managed a tag team like I am managing now. Let me introduce to you, I call him Rhythm and Blues!
I think that was his strength is that he could antagonize a crowd.
Right. And when he turned face, he became irrelevant.
Oh, yeah.
Especially as a Hogan crony.
That Gorilla called him a pipsqueak.
Oh, yeah. And even Bobby Heenan would, but he would pretend he wouldn't. He'd be like, that little runt.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, what did you say?
It was almost like the other managers resented, because Jimmy Hart, if you look at his resume, is kind of successful. Yeah.
He had tag champions a lot. He had the Intercontinental Champion.
He always seemed to have a champion.
He did. He was a successful manager.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, Jimmy Hart. Who are we forgetting now at the end of the 80s here?
From the end of the 80s? I mean, that's kind of the big three, or if you count Fuji, the big four of that era.
Right.
What happened is once Bobby wound down, you had Jimmy Hart still.
Right.
You had Harvey Whippleman. Like, who cares?
Yeah. This is where it gets rough, and this is where it starts to kind of end.
A bright spot was Cornette.
Clarence Mason.
Clarence Mason was okay, yeah.
Yeah.
And you'd have
Cornette
to say...
Cornette was kind of okay.
He was all right. He's not as good as he thinks he is.
Oh, yeah. Without question. Cornette was not the best manager, right?
No, like, he was good.
I always felt like he never wanted to take a bump because he took too many in NWA or something.
Yeah, he fucked his knees up.
Yeah.
But you know what? We got to give a couple of honorable mentions here to some good managers before we wrap up. Paul Heyman.
Yes, Paul Heyman. Or Paulie Dangerously.
Or Paulie Dangerously. Now, then and now. I mean,
he's the only guy that's carrying the manager mantle anymore.
He's the closest you can get to a Bobby Heenan type.
Yep.
He might be almost as good.
Paul is more serious.
He's more serious.
The idea is that Brain was... The idea with Brain was it was almost kind of like... Brain's supposed to be smart, but he really isn't. He's kind of doofy.
Yeah.
Paul Heyman is literally like a maniacal genius.
Yes.
Like, right? Like, he's an evil genius rather than a smart guy.
Yeah, that's true.
Like,
and you can trust him to do his damnedest to get something over.
I can't believe what he's doing right now with Brock.
Yeah.
How he turned that stupid loss into, no, this is a motivated Brock. You don't know what you've just...
Yeah, like, exactly. And
you've made it worse.
Right, like, and now a few weeks, what the hell's going to happen at the Rumble?
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
I want to know now because Heyman helped turn this around.
Yeah, because Heyman told me, oh shit, this guy's motivated now?
Right.
But Paul was better, like, he's always been good,
yeah.
He managed Sabu, RVD.
He's always been a great talker. The Dangerous Alliance.
Yes, the Dangerous Alliance.
You know, in WCW, speaking of them. You know what? I thought early Sonny was a great manager, too.
She was. I liked... The idea of her using people, it's all akin to Sherry, really.
Sherry was the best female manager ever.
I mean, before we even talk about Sonny, you have to say Sherry.
Yeah.
I mean, we had a whole thing on Sherry, but...
Yeah, and you can check it out on YouTube, by the way.
Yeah, you can. And Sherry is just... What more can you say than what we said?
One of the best there's ever been.
She's one of the best there's ever been. The reason that she was good is because she could get, as far as managing, if we're just talking about managing, is that she had all the nuances down.
Yes.
Like on an emotional level.
Yep. You know, the cool thing about Sherry is she got involved physically.
Right.
The same way a man would.
I mean,
that was cool.
Yeah. That she was a femme fatale.
She was a femme fatale. Now, I gotta say, and it's sad that he's no longer with us, one of the up-and-coming managers in my mind, we got to see him live a bunch of times, was Larry Sweeney.
Larry Sweeney. Wow.
He was,
you know what he should
awesome.
Have been? He was basically the successor to Bobby the Brain Heenan. Like, he would have been, like, the best thing ever.
He was awesome.
He could do it all. He could take a bump. He could get a crowd pissed off.
He could talk. He was great.
He could talk. He could manage a stable.
Yep, he did. Sweet and Sour Inc.
Yeah.
Quinn and I had the privilege of seeing him numerous times at ROH.
I loved him.
Yeah, he was fantastic.
Really, really good.
So the manager in itself, I mean, you got your Paul Heyman. Summer Rae was good for a while at ringside.
She's okay. I mean,
she was.
I feel like they never gave her the chance.
No.
The funniest Summer Rae managing thing to me was when she managed Rusev briefly.
That was so stupid.
But
yeah.
She was funny about it because she would like call him like Ruru and like and how she proposed to him. She was like so in love with him.
Yeah.
Like,
she may not be much in the ring, but Summer's actually pretty talented. She's pretty good.
I'm glad to hear that because there's something about her, like,
yeah.
I don't know what it is, but she's just very good at what she does.
She has some nuance,
yeah.
You know, some character.
They might not give her the chance to have that
nuance.
They
never will.
But whenever they do,
if.
It comes out.
Yeah.
Especially that Rusev thing, and hell, she even, like, the Fandango stuff was fun.
I liked her with Fandango.
Yeah.
I liked how she would react to things at ringside. It was like his match mattered.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Like, she's hanging on his every whim.
So I guess to wrap this one up, I mean, yeah, I'm glad you brought that one up, Quinn. Managers are definitely something that, when done right, really enhance the product.
Yeah, exactly.
Don't you think?
I agree. That's why I brought it up.
I think so.
Yeah.
And it's sad that there aren't as many of them as there used to be. Now everyone has to deliver their own horribly scripted promo.
You can't have managers anymore because everything's scripted. The whole point of a manager is they're ad-libbing, basically.
Yeah, that was one of their original things, to talk.
Right. And if they can't even talk on their own, of their own accord, then what the hell's the point of them?
Yeah, now you got 20 guys in a room writing stuff for people to say.
Notice the only guy that they let talk is the only manager they really have is Paul Heyman.
Yeah. That's true. It's a good point.
Yep.
So we're going to transition right into our next segment, which is called One of My Favorites. And Quinn, one of my favorite things, I think you'll like this one.
Yeah.
Was the Winged Eagle belt.
Oh, yeah. I love the Winged Eagle belt. It's so good. That is the WWF championship.
To me, too, right?
They should just bring it back.
It is the epitome of the WWF championship belt.
Yeah.
And, folks, if you don't know what the Winged Eagle is, that was the belt that was used. Hogan was the first one to wear it. He wore it to the ring at the main event, February 2nd, 1988, to fight Andre.
I love it. Just looks so squeaky clean at that point,
doesn't it?
Like
brand new,
bright, like gold.
Yep.
Like the gold is just shining.
Yep.
Like,
it was the one awarded to Randy Savage, of course, when he won the world title at WrestleMania 4, and then it passed through the hands of Hogan, Ultimate Warrior, Sergeant Slaughter.
Yep,
Hogan again. Undertaker had it. Flair,
Shawn Michaels,
Bret Hart.
The list goes on. Right, Diesel had it.
Steve Austin was the last to have it.
Right.
The night after WrestleMania, he unceremoniously dropped it on Vince's foot, which was comedic.
Now,
Vince gave him
one more time, if I remember, right? It was like for Kane or something like a case.
Yes, I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah.
Sometime in like September of 98, Vince was going to award the world title because it was vacant after Breakdown pay-per-view.
Yeah.
And it was the old Winged Eagle
in
the case.
I got excited.
So did
I was like, oh, good, they're going to go back to this one.
But, of course, Austin crashed the ceremony, possibly with the Zamboni, I'm not sure.
I think, and then I think he won the title back that night, and then the smoking skull appeared.
We just never saw the, Eagle.
Yeah.
And
until it became the hardcore title.
Yeah, but that was like that was intentional.
Yeah.
The Winged Eagle was the belt where if you had the wrestling figure and you had the belt, you wanted to make your guy win that title so you could put it on him and see how it looked.
Now, the Hasbro one, it was like silvery, though. It wasn't gold.
I know, but I loved the way it looked.
Yeah, it was awesome. You know what? You know what? That belt is interesting to me.
What?
Most world titles, the middle part's like really big.
Yes.
But the Winged Eagle, it's smaller.
I've heard that as a criticism, but to
I
me,
like it.
Just yeah, it just looks so classy.
It looks classy. It looks even.
It does.
Like, it doesn't make the side panels look shitty.
Right. There were some, like, real disasters of belts before that. Like, the one Hogan won from the Iron Sheik.
That one is terrible. You know why it's bad?
Why?
It's just got too much going on it. Like, it's got, like, an Olympic man in the front, and it's like just a stupid circle. It's got that
green. It looks like a hubcap on the front of it.
Yeah, so it makes that look like a hubcap. And then, like, the other problem with it is to hold those little platelets with all the champions, it's, like, super wide on the sides. Like, it's almost, like, wider than the belt itself.
Yeah, it looks really doofy.
It's terrible.
It looks like a collection of, like, silver plates.
I like to think the champagne melted that in the Andre Hogan celebration.
Nice
yeah,
you're
you.
The champion now.
Yeah. That's nice of you. I'm really proud of you.
And then Hogan had a decent one, like, in the mid-80s, like WrestleMania, like, 2
that
and stuff
okay.
like that. That one's okay.
The one at 3.
Yeah,
yeah, that
3.
One's not, that one's okay. But that's, like, it's, like, almost like the prototype because it starts adding that, like, hump on the top
thing. Yeah,
it gets
humpy on top.
Which is what the Winged Eagle kind of was. It was, like, a circle that kind of came out a little bit of its shell, right?
It just looked like champion to me.
Yeah, and yeah, it's just, it's a better belt, and it is not the first small design belt like that, because if you notice, the world title in the 70s is kind of like a smaller design.
Well, they had a different guy making them back then.
They all look the same.
Yeah, I know. They had Reggie Parks make all those belts in the 80s, and he did the IC, he did the tag.
Those crappy ones before the good ones,
No,
right?
No, Reggie Parks did the good ones.
Oh,
I'm
he
saying.
Did the good ones.
He did the good ones.
I was going to bring that up, actually.
Yeah, we can talk about other belts, too.
Because I like the whole series of belts from that era. I like what the tag belts look like. I like what the Intercontinental
title. Oh, God.
The Intercontinental, I mean, the Intercontinental, everyone loves what the Intercontinental.
I love
to this
that.
Point, they brought it
they
back.
They actually brought
it
back.
It is still the Intercontinental. But I think really the tag belts get overlooked.
They were great.
Those belts look like one of them is a big deal. Not just, like, they look like a guy could come to the ring by themselves and those could be a world title.
Absolutely.
You know, like.
It's a great belt.
And not to mention, in that era, I know it's completely unrelated, but the Million Dollar Belt. Also
oh, yeah,
awesome.
Of course. Like, I mean, only a couple of guys have ever held it. You
yeah,
know?
And Virgil's
Virgil
one
was one of them. Steve Austin was one of them.
Yeah.
And I believe Ted DiBiase Jr. was one of them.
Yes, that's the one I was forgetting. Did Goldust win it from him somehow?
I hope not.
I don't know.
I don't think so.
There's got to be a definitive million-dollar champion list.
Million-dollar champion
Now, the only one that looks stupid in that time period, if I recall, was the ladies' belt.
Yeah, but it's not that they gave a crap about
no.
the ladies' division.
Is that the one that... Did they still, in that time, have the one with Moolah's face on it?
No, I don't think so. Did they?
When was the one, the Sherry belt.
The one Sherry had in, like, 88.
That's not the Medusa belt, because that one's actually good.
The Medusa one's okay.
Yeah. I actually like that they, on the new women's title, that they made it white, like the Medusa belt.
Yeah.
I did like that.
I like that, too.
That was, like, a little nod.
Now, Quinn, what did you think of the belt that came right after the Winged Eagle? The big
the blue
eagle.
One?
Yeah, I think they call it the big eagle or the...
I like the blue one. The problem with the blue one is they didn't really use it until Triple H.
Yeah, because Austin almost immediately had the smoking skull, right?
Yeah, and then, like, yeah, it was just like you never saw it. And then, like, it really was by the time, like, Triple H was the... The Rock
The
had
Rock
it.
Used it sometimes.
Yeah, The Rock used it sometimes, too. But didn't even The Rock and I have it all the time? Like, I feel like it wasn't used regularly until Triple H.
I think it was Triple H was... Well, no, The Rock used it.
He did. He
I don't
did
really...
At WrestleMania 15, I think.
16.
What's the one where The Rock faced Austin the first time?
Oh, The Rock you're talking about. 15, sorry.
Yeah, Rock had that blue
belt. He had it, yeah.
Yeah.
He had it, but the smoking skull was like anytime Austin had it, pretty
which
much.
Which was like all of the late
which
90s.
Which was a lot of...
Yeah, it was like... I felt like they almost had to just keep it... The smoking skull. It almost like when John Cena had the spinny belt.
Yeah.
It felt like the reason they never went back for so long was because Cena was just always winning the title back a million times. So, like, it would be dumb to switch it. Like,
right. That was going to get me to the Cena one. The Undisputed one I kind of liked. From, like, 01, 02.
Yeah.
Before the spinny.
I like it. It's okay. This is actually... It's interesting. We're talking about belts.
Yes.
I actually wish... I like the idea of a undisputed unified champion coming in the ring with two belts.
Do you?
I do, because I think it just makes them look better. Like, I think it's awesome. Like,
what do you think of their belt design now? The Universal and all that stuff?
Okay, so it's like...
just a giant logo.
Well, okay, so I actually, believe it or not, I like the World Heavyweight Championship.
Why?
I don't know. It just kind of works because it's the black and all that. Okay. It's fine. All right. That's fine, right?
Yeah.
Where it gets stupid is the tag titles.
Why?
Because they're just, they look like big pennies. Like, they look...
they do.
Yeah, they look like big pennies.
I agree.
And then, finally, they have a chance to redesign the tag titles right for SmackDown, right?
Yes.
And what do? They just do the pennies
blue
with
pennies.
Blue. Like,
blue
what?
Pennies.
No, get rid of the pennies. They gotta go. The pennies
look like shit.
Why would you make the tag titles bronze? Like, it just makes them look shittier.
It does. The tag belts look like shit. At least the Intercontinental looks good.
Yes.
You know?
You know what? I've got... the U.S. title has grown on me just because they haven't altered it
for
so long.
Yeah, it's not bad, actually.
Yeah, it's really not a bad
it's
belt.
Not.
Like, it, honestly, it's a good, like... you know, it's a good successor to the other U.S.
It's
style.
Solid.
Yeah,
it's solid.
It's solid, yeah.
You know, one of my least favorite belts from WWE was the redesigned Intercontinental in 98?
Yeah.
When they got rid of the classic
design. I liked
design.
It at first.
Ugh.
And then,
horrid.
Actually, it was over time I started hating it because it just felt less and less meaningful.
What, like a 16-year-old designed that? It looked like shit. It just looked terrible.
It looked like garbage.
It looked like an unlicensed, like, Korean video game belt.
It's funny because
like
it does...
like Mr. Ding Ding versus, like, Chip Chop Boardwalk.
But it does make...
I'm not being offensive. I'm saying, like, the game is offensive.
Yeah, but it does matter what the belt looks like a little bit, right?
It matters what the belt looks like, yes.
Yeah, because especially in the Intercontinental's case, it almost... even though they were the ones booking it,
they devalued it by changing the design.
Yeah, it still... It didn't matter if it was the best booking in the world. The belt looks like the
I wouldn't
want to
win
that somebody's carrying around with them.
Right, and that's why it annoyed me that they kept the spinner belt and the design of it for so damn long. You just
something
look like a tool holding that thing.
The thing with the spinner belt is, if you notice, after even John Cena had it, they took the spinner, it didn't spin anymore. And it actually looked okay once it didn't spin anymore.
I don't know if I'd say it looked okay.
Some belts just grow on you no matter how dumb they look.
True.
And that was one of them. It just kind of grew on me.
Well,
like that's all. It's not. I'm not saying it's good.
It's not.
Yeah.
The Winged Eagle is my favorite.
The Winged Eagle, without question.
Without question.
Yeah. I mean, it is the best. An Intercontinental title, close second.
Sure.
Honorable mention, though. TV title.
WCW TV title was great.
We're mentioning TV title again in this episode.
And big gold belt. You can't beat that. I mean, that's a great belt too. You don't like it?
Neither here or there with the big old... the big old belt is good as, like I said, a unified secondary belt that you're holding. Because
it
looks like a legacy belt.
That's what it was.
Yeah.
In WWE.
Well, I'm saying as WCW's main title, I didn't like it as the main belt.
It was better than their world title that they had in, like, the mid-90s before they got that
belt
back.
What did you think of the original Cruiserweight title?
It's okay. Kind of like, whatever.
Yeah.
Not a huge fan of it.
Did you like the ECW title?
Yes,
that's a
I
unique
did.
Title.
Yes, I like the ECW title.
It with the, like, kind of barbed wire like etched into it.
Yeah, that version of it.
Yeah,
that
one's pretty good.
It.
And I actually like the ECW TV title. It was pretty good.
Yeah, wasn't that somewhat like the Intercontinental, if I'm not mistaken, or was it
at
their...
first? But then they ECW-fied it once they had a little money.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
That version I'm talking about. So
there you go. That's one of my favorites, though, Quinn.
Yeah. It's a good one.
The Winged Eagle.
It's a good one, because I love the Winged Eagle, yeah.
You had that with you. You looked like a champion. Speaking of champions, folks, we'll be back right after this.
In trying to make an artistic statement, one should be careful not to let one's personal aroma do the talking. In order not to offend the critics, I recommend RightGuard Sport Stick. It provides maximum protection and the freshest scents, a sublime palette of odoriferous emanations. After all, a true artiste should be remembered for his inspiration, not his perspiration. Right Guard Sports Stick. Anything less would be uncivilized.
And welcome back to Our Vantage Point, the Retro Wrestling Podcast. We thank you for joining us on episode number 13, January 9th, 2017. Quinn, we're reviewing something.
Yes, we are.
Oh, we're reviewing one for you, folks.
Yeah.
This is a fun one, actually. We both enjoyed watching this.
Yes, we did.
This is a co-branded show, the WWF and the SWS, the Super World of Sports, is what this stands for.
For some reason, I kept thinking it was the SWF.
You SMS, you kept saying?
SMS or something, yeah. Like,
this is
PMS. What is this?
This is SWS, WWF, Wrestle Dream. So I guess it didn't happen. Someone dreamt it.
It's like Mario 2.
Yeah, it's like Mario 2. Wart is in it and stuff like that. April 1st, 1991. So we're about a week removed from WrestleMania. And this is in Kobe, Japan.
Makes it particularly interesting because of that.
Yeah, exactly. It's right after WrestleMania 7.
And I really don't think any kayfabe storylines apply here.
No.
Other than Hagen being the champ.
Yeah, Hagen's the champ. Yeah. We'll get to him. This promotion, SWS, was by Tenryu, Japanese superstar.
Yeah, I don't really like him.
But it existed for a couple...
Got a bad Jerry curl.
It existed for a couple of years, I think 90 to 92.
Now, are they supposed to be, like, strong style, like, before that
somewhat.
Was cool?
Yeah, well, they were, like, All Japan and New Japan defects, you
but
know?
But I meant, like, that they were supposed to be, like, no, this is the rougher wrestling. Because I kind of got the impression...
Yeah.
From the show.
It's such good wrestling that wrestling's not even in their promotion name. Yeah, right? No, this is the Super World of Sports, motherfucker.
Yeah, it's super, all right.
It's super.
We got WWF.
Yes, they did. And they co-promoted with them for a while. This is a show that they did, and I believe that we're watching an edited version. I don't know if it was something that was tape-traded and put on YouTube, or maybe if it aired in Japan this way.
It looks, the way it's clipped, it looks like somebody had a tape of just the WWF matches.
Yeah. Because
it's very, like... It doesn't look cutty.
Yeah,
like, it's
very
like, it's
succinct.
Very professionally done.
Yeah, it's very succinct.
Yeah.
So this is only the WWF matches from this card. It's hosted by who the hell knows because they
some
don't
Japanese
show.
Guys.
Just some Japanese
so,
guys.
We might want to remind the audience we had no commentary here.
No commentary.
Blah, 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 you know?
Sorry, we don't speak Japanese.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, for our Japanese listeners.
Yes.
Who understand what we're saying right now.
So the first match... Give me a break. The first match is Earthquake, John Tenta, we love him, versus Quinn's favorite.
Fucking Katao.
Fucking Koji Katao. Hand towel. Fred Katao.
Fred Hand towel.
Fresh off of his victory with Tenryu at WrestleMania 7
they
against...
They make Demolition look dumb.
What music did Demolition have, Quinn?
Ding!
So,
like that terrible music.
Quinn, what do you think of Earthquake here?
What do I think of him?
Yeah.
His hair's longer, and it's bad. he looks like he just woke up.
He looks pretty rough.
I would say everyone at this show that's on the American side doesn't look like they got a lot of sleep.
Yeah, that's true, like, and they probably didn't.
No, they look like shit.
There was a show a couple of days earlier in Tokyo, and that's where Tenta fought Katao the first time, and it was... Everything went fine, 10-1. This is an infamous match. You've probably heard of it if you're up on this stuff. It degenerates into a shoot.
Right. Now, before we get there, let's remark on some of the stuff.
Yeah.
So they come out, and there's, like, military police or something.
Yeah,
like,
their security guards are intense.
Yeah, they have, like decorative, like, epaulettes on their jackets. Like, what are they protecting here? This is wrestling.
They're protecting Earthquake, apparently, because he looks like he's going to fall asleep in any second.
You
love Katao
so
much.
Oh, I hate him. My first comment was Katao blows.
Yes.
He is a big fat asshole. He's got like spandex on, but he has a belt.
He looks like just such a dick wipe. Like, he's just such an asshole.
You can just tell he thinks he's hot shit.
Yeah.
And you know what about him being hot shit? I bet you half the people who are listening to this retro podcast who are big-time fans don't even know who the hell he is.
Koji Katao.
Yeah.
Let us know. He was a former sumo. Did you know that, Quinn? He was a Yokozuna.
Yeah, he's a fat ass. he had to lose some weight for this.
So they got co-branded turnbuckles, which was a nice touch.
That was good. On one side was WWF, like the regular you see, and the other side said SWS or SMS or whatever they are, PMS.
And the ref is extremely tiny.
Yes.
Especially compared to these two big guys.
Now, the refs, interestingly enough, the Japanese refs kind of have the WWF ref garb,
they
if
do.
I recall.
They're wearing the WWF ref garb. It's a very tense atmosphere, almost as if these two guys knew some shit was going to go down.
Yeah, so something starts happening in this match, and they're not cooperating.
Right.
This match is very interesting, because this is kind of why people sought this out in the first place.
I've seen this match outside of this show before.
Right. So basically what happens is that If I recall, the match starts, that Earthquake kind of goes for a wrestling takedown, right?
It's shoot fighty, but they might be cooperating. It's hard to tell.
It's hard to tell, but after that first takedown by Earthquake, all of a sudden Katao gets all mad, and he like knocks over a table and like throws it at Earthquake, and then they start they're yelling at each other.
He thinks he's so good, and basically Earthquake's having none of it, does not back down, and it just degenerates, if you remember, Quinn.
Now, I'm with Earthquake because it seems like Katao started it.
It does seem like Katao started
it. Like, without question, and I think we find that out later, not on this show or anything, but if you look it up.
Yes.
Like, basically, like, he didn't cooperate with them, and he was going to, like, legit fight Earthquake. And listen, John Tenta is a good man because he did not fucking back down to this asshole.
Absolutely.
He knew he was bigger than him.
Yep.
That he could control everything.
And he's a former sumo himself.
Yeah, and he was like, he's basically like, listen, this is the WWF you're dealing with, pal.
This is my job.
We're the biggest promotion in the world. Fuck you. I'm not gonna go down. And he like legit fights him.
They're circling each other. It's very tense.
It's like nobody wants to like get hit with like a knockout. Like you can tell like that's like the mentality. It's that they don't want to get in a hold.
Yep.
Or they don't want to get hit in the face so that they make their promotion look dumb.
Right. And if you remember, Quinn, Katao tries to break Earthquake's arm.
Yes.
And that's where Earthquake really loses
He starts saying, like, fuck to him and stuff like that.
Yeah, Earthquake is basically like, you want to fucking poke me in the eye? Because he tries to poke him in the eye.
Like, legit gouge him. Like, not like a wrestling poke to the eye. Like, I'm talking like, no, this guy wants to take his eye out of his socket.
It's just very tense. There's not a lot of contact made. It's a lot of them taunting, circling. Quinn in the middle of this is just like, look at this piece of garbage. Fuck him.
Yeah.
Talking about Katao.
The ref tries to maintain control.
He does his best, yeah.
Yeah, and the crowd starts chanting Tenta.
Yeah, they're clearly behind John Tenta here.
Yeah, they know.
Katao sucks.
Katao, like, fucked up. Like,
at one point, Earthquake's like, this is pro wrestling. Remember that when he yells at him?
It's something. It's quite a spectacle, honestly.
It really is. It has to be seen to be fully understood, so you should definitely check this match out, folks. Yeah. John Tenta versus Koji Katao.
Just absolutely bizarre.
Yep.
It ends with Katao.
Like, legit.
The ref's trying to break it up, and he kicks him.
He just kicks the ref.
It actually hurts him.
Yeah.
Like, and they have to take the ref away.
Yep, and that's
and
just it.
They just end the match, and it's
a no contest.
Awarded to Earthquake, actually.
Oh, is it actually?
It says
okay.
Winner Earthquake.
Oh, you're right, it does.
Okay, so that's the thing in this.
Yeah,
after every match, there's this small screen, and it kind of shows, like, a couple of clips from the match, but not, like, in a replay style, just, like, a quick cut.
Very
to, like,
quick.
And it just says in Japanese, winner.
Yeah.
Like, well, it says winner in English. Then some Japanese,
yeah.
I guess, the name of the wrestler.
So, Quinn, I thought this was bizarre. What's your rating on this?
Where did this take place again?
Oh, this is in Kobe, Japan.
Oh, 5 stars.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah.
So the next match is Bret Hart, all people.
Yeah, Bret the Hitman Hart.
Yeah, versus George Takano. So when Bret comes down, and what happens with the ribbons?
So he gets the respect ribbons, which is,
it's real.
That's still a thing in Japan,
it's
actually.
It's real, yeah.
Like, people are like, oh shit, Bret Hart. And they're like, yeah, he's good.
Yeah,
like,
respect ribbons.
Respect ribbons.
You like Takano's music.
Takano's music is good. I think all the Japanese wrestlers actually have good music because it just sounds like video game music.
Yeah. No, Takano's music is particularly good, but his attire is particularly not good.
Okay, so he has, like, women's boots. Like, it looks like he's wearing, like, lady shoes?
Yes.
Like,
they're, like, white and short. They're, like,
weird
boots.
No. Not the white part, just the black part surrounding. You know, like, a woman's shoe that's, like, a flat?
Yes.
That's what he looks like he's wearing with socks, but it's all part of his boots.
He also has, like, a Beverly Brothers cape.
Yeah. He just looks like a lady.
He looks like Tito Santana dressed as a Beverly Brother in lady shoes.
Yeah. He looks like a complete idiot is what I said.
Yeah. Bret, honestly, and I love Bret, and I know he didn't always give it 100%, he looks like he could give a shit about being
Again,
there.
Again, he looks tired like the rest of them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Quinn thinks Takano looks like The Rock.
Yeah, and with stupid shorts. Because they're, like, long. Longer green, like neon green.
Yeah. Now, we kind of notice Bret kind of works this as a heel, like, subtle.
Yeah, it appears to me that Takano is supposed to be a face in Japan, so they're like, they don't want to kill that because they're in their home territory.
So Bret's kind of like a subtle heel, and he's also got his WrestleMania 7 gear on, like, exactly.
Takano hits a pile driver.
Big deal.
But
you know,
Brett kicks out. Pile driver in 91 is like a big deal.
Yeah. Quinn keeps calling a Takano Tato.
Yeah. Like potato.
Yeah. And the announcers keep saying Brett Hardo.
Brett Hardo.
I'm not being mean. That's really what they said.
That is how they pronounce it.
And Brett's kind of like, it's just funny. I'm just noticing the way he was wrestling. He's being like kind of assholic, but
yeah,
not like rule breaking.
Like aggressive.
Heel. Yeah. He's just being kind of jerky.
Yeah, he's just wrestling a heel style. Brett with the Boston Crab, since he wasn't using the sharpshooter.
Yeah, which is interesting.
Yeah, that is weird.
It was like he knew he wanted the submission hold, but he didn't
now,
have the sharpshooter.
Now, what I like about this Boston Crab spot is Takano does push-ups to get out of it. Like,
yeah, like
actual
literal
legit
push-ups.
Push-ups while he's in the Boston Crab and like pushes Brett out of it.
Yeah, that was a cool escape, I thought,
yeah,
honestly. And so it's back and forth. Then Takano hits a spinning heel kick.
Yup.
Big splash.
Big splash, top rope.
For the pin. Yeah, good match, I thought. Quinn, what do you think?
What was the nationality of the crowd?
Japanese.
Oh, 5 stars.
Okay,
yeah.
Right. So then we move on to one of Quinn's favorites.
The Macho Man.
That's right, against one of Quinn's least favorites, Tenryu.
Ugh, Jerry Curl Tenryu. Now, Macho Man is supposed to be retired here, which is weird.
Yeah, but like you said, no kayfabe storylines are really applying.
There just seems to be no kayfabe at all.
Also, no Elizabeth and no Sherry.
None of that. Yeah.
And somehow Earl Hebner now is the ref. We get an American ref.
They finally switched the refs up. I guess maybe that was the agreement here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, Quimino, know how you feel about Katao?
He's a piece of garbage.
Yeah, what about Tenryu?
Tenryu, yeah.
He's a piece of garbage, too.
They're both pieces of garbage. You know why? Because they beat Demolition. Fuck them. This fat tub with his dinosaur jacket comes out.
Yeah, their mascot's like a T-Rex.
Literally a T-Rex on the back of their jacket.
Are you sure it's not like a little baby Godzilla, maybe?
It's weird because they're like the Power Ranger-style T-Rex, like the Tyrannosaur.
Tyrannosaur?
Yeah, Tyrannosaur. Remember how Jason, I
Tyrannosaurus.
Think his name. Yeah, but Tyrannosaurus.
Mastodon.
Tyrannosaurus.
So anyway, the match gets off to a hot start. Tenryu storms to ringside and Savage is like throwing his jacket at him.
Yeah, it's Savage with the stalling pretty much the whole match.
Yeah, it's like 1986 Savage returned.
Yeah, but he's still like good.
He's still good.
He's in his WrestleMania 7 gear.
That's true, but he's got the shirt this time.
Yeah. Well, he doesn't take the shirt
off.
Yeah,
he keeps the
shirt
on.
But it's the same shirt that he had at the beginning of the match.
Same shirt. This is apparently like the WrestleMania 7 gear show.
Right,
you know?
Yeah, exactly. It's like, basically, they're like, let's just wear the same thing.
So, I love this. Savage gets on the mic in front of the Japanese crowd, and he yells, "Ooh, yeah, Tenryu, I'm gonna get you now, and there ain't nothing you can do about it, ooh, yeah.
Ooh, yeah, Tenryu, I'm gonna get you now, and there ain't nothing you can do about it, ooh, yeah."
I don't get this because was there supposed to be some kind of backstory
here? I
don't
think so. I don't
know.
Was
Macho Man mad about that demolition match like I was? Like, I don't understand. Did they, like, did he challenge him backstage after he lost his career match?
It might have been that he woke him up because Tenryu seriously looks like he just got up from a nap.
How old is he here? Like, a 70? Like,
I don't know.
He looks like garbage. Like, he looks old. Like,
he does.
Not like, I'm not saying he looks like garbage because I don't like him. He legitimately looks bad. Like, he shouldn't be wrestling.
He might be about the same age Shawn Michaels was when Michaels retired.
Oh.
But Michaels looked a million times better than this guy. So, I guess Savage is working heel. He's technically not a face yet. He didn't turn face.
But, I mean, he had that moment with Elizabeth only a couple days ago. But do you think these Japanese people had seen WrestleMania 7?
According to Gorilla, that was the largest pay-per-view audience in the history
of pay-per-view.
Oh, right.
The whole world saw it. So,
yeah,
I guess they did. So, they must be confused as we are.
There's a Japanese fan that yells at Savage. He's wearing a suit.
Yeah.
Japanese fan in a business suit. Awesome.
Yeah.
And then, so for this clip, Savage shittily, like, offers a handshake and then just takes it away and he yells, "You ain't nothing!"
It's so weird. Like, the Savage, even his heelness is not normal.
Yeah,
like,
I know.
It's, like, very bizarre. It's like, he just keeps trying to antagonize Tenryu because he's just boring.
Right, so they brawl to the crappy ringside table, the same one Katao threw earlier.
Yeah, it's back in his place now.
Quinn, you have an interesting theory of
I said, this guy thinks he's good because they beat Demolition the week before with the crappy music.
So that makes Katao and Tenryu good. They just think they're good.
Yeah. And I also commented about Savage. I still don't get why Vince thinks he needs the shirt. Because he looks really good here. It's true.
He does.
Yeah.
I don't know why. I would also like to take this moment to mention that I do not like Earl Hebner.
I don't get it. He's fine.
I'm not explaining it right now. Yeah, so anyway, flying elbow by Savage, but he stalls, so it only gets a two. Tenryu with his finisher, the power bomb, but Savage kicks out.
So they've kicked out of each other's finisher.
Just like WrestleMania 7.
Yeah.
This guy is no Ultimate Warrior. Tenryu with a, what was that, a backwards elbow?
Yeah, backwards elbow drop. I don't even remember saying this, honestly.
I noted it for you, though.
Yeah. I said, fat fall on him move, question mark? That is awful. Yeah, you better kick out of that, Macho Man.
And then Quinn says, yeah, poke him in the eye. He sucks.
Fuck him.
Fuck him. Yeah. Savage hits another elbow, then a second.
Yeah,
and Tenryu still fucking kicks out.
What the fuck?
Who is this guy?
Why is... I own the promotion. I can just kick out of finishers by, like, legends.
This prompts you to say...
I hate Tenryu. Yeah. What the fuck? It's the Macho Man. Like, come on.
And then Quinn proceeds to explain that SWS stands for what?
Small wrestling shit.
We go to a clip to the outside. You know, it shows a sign.
Oh, I like this. There's a sign on the ring apron that says official sponsor, Nishimashu Construction Company.
That doesn't sound shady.
Yeah, what is it, the Mafia?
So with that, Tenryu...
Sorry, the Yakuza.
Yeah, the Yakuza. Tenryu hits his crappy-ass powerbomb again for the win.
He beats Macho Man.
Quinn, you love that, right? Talk about only winning because you own the company.
That's what I see. That was exactly what I said.
Yes.
I also said, good thing this company went out of business because it sure does suck. I mean, their logo is a T-Rex.
And then it shows on the screen, winner.
Winner, this fat ass with the worst powerbomb ever.
So, Quinn, what would you rate this?
What was the... Kobe?
Yeah, Kobe, Japan.
Do you think they went to Ribera after this match?
Yeah.
5 stars.
Cool. So, next match, we get some imitation Brutus Beefcake music, that's what I thought of it, for Yoshiyatsu.
I'm reading the notes, I thought it said Yoshitatsu,
it's
I
not.
Swear.
As he takes on Hogan.
For the world title.
For the world title.
It's on the what did this guy do?
I don't know, but I'll tell you what.
He's not if he was Tenryu, he'd be the world champion.
Yeah.
After this, but.
So this is Japan.
Yeah.
So Hogan is so much more likable in Japan.
Well, he's like a real wrestler.
He's basically like, fuck you, I'm here. There's none of this like, tearing the shirt, like all dramatically.
Yep.
He is so much more serious looking because he knows what the Japanese crowd responds to.
He's serious and he's doing like moves. Like not like playing his face style where he's like getting beat up the whole time by like punches. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
he looks good here. He really does.
And his finisher isn't the elbow drop. Like
the leg drop, you mean?
I'm sorry, leg drop. It's the
Axe Bomber!
Axe Bomber!
Which is basically a lariat.
Yeah.
This is a pretty good little match, I thought.
Yeah.
I mean, Hogan does his usual Japan style. I don't want to blow it out of proportion, but he's a decent mat wrestler.
It's something
in Japan
that he doesn't get credit for is that really the whole time he did really know how to wrestle. Like he wasn't just some jabroni that could like sit on people and like win.
He knew what crowds wanted and he worked accordingly.
It really highlights there's a reason why Hogan was the best in the world at the time because he could adapt to anything.
We've seen him, just to go off on a tangent here, we saw a great brawl with him in Japan, I think from 90, against Stan Hansen. Remember
that's
that?
Really good.
It's an awesome brawl.
He can turn his style on a dime, really. Like he can just be whatever he needs to be, and it's no, there's like really no like question in my mind why Hogan is probably one of the best of all time. It's like right here, it's just on display.
Absolutely.
Like,
and again, I don't want to say he's like the best mat wrestler ever.
No,
he's
not saying he's the best wrestler. I'm just saying he knows how
he
to
knew what
work
he was
a
doing.
Crowd.
Yep.
Probably the best crowd like worker ever.
One of the best ever. Yeah. And this is a great, you know, decent, fun little match here. Earl Fuckner is the ref again. Fuck him. So. This has a little interesting bit of psychology. Yatsu keeps avoiding the Axe Bomber.
Yeah.
Hogan finally hits it.
Yeah, it's basically a fight till Hogan can hit that Axe Bomber.
And he wins with it.
Yeah. Not the most like amazing match, but I mean it was fun seeing Hogan
it was very fun seeing Hogan in Japan. I like seeing Hogan in Japan. It's different.
Yeah, I always get a kick out of Hogan in Japan.
I do too. So Quinn, what'd you think of that match?
Was this like a title match in Japan?
Yes it was. It was in Japan.
Oh, it's 5 stars then.
There you go.
Okay.
So overall, I thought it was a great little show.
Well, I mean, it's a great show. Every match is 5 stars, right?
It was a nice little show. I want to bring this up to you, Quinn, as an epilogue.
Okay.
This isn't in our notes or anything, okay. But just because you like Tenryu so much.
Oh.
And we like Japan Hogan so much. In September of 91, there was another show.
There was?
And the main event was Hulk Hogan versus Tenryu.
Okay, who wins that?
Tenryu kicks out of the leg drop.
Well, that's not Hogan's Japanese finisher, so that makes sense.
Kicks out of the first Axe Bomber.
No way!
But finally, Hogan gives him two more and pins his ass.
Oh my god. Tenryu is garbage. Like, why does everyone think he's so good?
I don't know.
Why did they think they could center a promotion? It's no wonder that PMS went out of business.
PMS can only last for so long.
Yeah, it's only temporary.
So, folks, there you have it. We have reviewed something.
Yeah.
SWS WWF Wrestle Dream
from
April 1st.
Now we can say we have Japan wrestling in our repertoire.
Yeah, we really are.
The Retro Japanese Wrestling Podcast. That's what we are now. Add that to our resume.
Yeah, you hear that? Yeah. You hear that, all you wrestling fans?
You hear that, IWC? We're peaking right
we've
now.
We've upped our game, yeah. Folks. Hey, we are the fastest growing weekly episodic retro wrestling audio podcast in the world.
Including Japanese wrestling. Japanese wrestling.
Maybe next time we'll add some Lucha Libre to our resume,
yeah.
Quinn. Folks, I want to remind you as we wrap it up here that we are going to have Scott Keith with us in a few weeks.
Oh, really
Keith
now?
He posted on the date. Yeah, he's coming back.
Oh, boy.
He's coming back for the Royal Rumble special.
Are we flying him in this time? Or?
And I think he'll still do this one from Canada.
We should do that show from Japan.
It'll be our best one ever.
Yeah, we'll get 5 stars on the internet.
Folks, it's been a great time. Quinn, it's been awesome talking to you.
Yep.
Thank you, of course,
as
folks.
As always.
Yep.
Great time talking to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for joining us. Have a good rest of your day, whether it's just beginning or just winding down. Thanks for listening to us. Hopefully, we've helped you pass an hour of your day.
Yep.
Be sure, of course, to tweet at us at OVP Podcast. You can email us at ovppodcast@gmail.com. That is ovppodcast@gmail.com. Subscribe on the iTunes, right,
the
Quinn?
The iTunes, the Google Play Music, the Stitcher. Go to the website, ovppodcast.com.
Right.
We got everything there. You don't have to look. It's all there.
It's all there. YouTube, yeah. We're on that. We're not on MySpace yet, I checked.
Yep. Well, maybe Japanese MySpace. Next. That's like the next. I'll have to look for that on the internet.
Folks, have a great rest of your day. We will see you next week.
See ya.
5 times World Wrestling Federation champion. This belt is just a toy. It's like a trinket on a Christmas tree, like an ornament. The belt that I want is the one that the great Muta has, the IWGP belt. Because when Hulk Hogan wins the IWGP championship, which he should have right now, it will prove that New Japan Pro Wrestling and Hulk Hogan is the greatest partners in the world, because I want all the great wrestlers to come to me, and I want them to come to Japan where I can wrestle and not bullshit. I want to wrestle and prove that I'm the best. There's an old saying in the United States of America, and that you cannot teach an old dog new tricks. But this old dog does not need new tricks. I know all the tricks. I've proven that I'm a survivor. I've proven that I'm a leader. And I will not quit professional wrestling. Many people you've seen quit and come back. But if you watch Hulk Hogan, I have never quit. I will always be here. And now that I'm back in Japan, tonight was a great night for me because I was very worried. Because Muta is a brand new star. He's one of the best New Japan has. And tonight, it was fun. It was easy. I want bigger challenges. I want more opponents. If Antonio Inoki has time to step down from his government job at the Senate, I would love to wrestle.
Will you stop?